Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In which inflation is said not a single time, but supply chains? Oh, that's our new jam. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 21st of June. Good, as always, to have you along. Everybody, you know, we try on this program to connect the dots, to give context to the seemingly random happenings in this economy. And that today takes us to the oil and gas markets and the observation that the price of a gallon of gas today in this country at just over $3 per is a whole dollar more expensive than it was a year ago. And if you've got long delayed vacation plans, what should you be paying attention to, do you wonder? Vaccinations, yes, of course. Variants of the virus, of course, also. The wider economic recovery, for sure. Also, though, Iran. Yes, Iran, because an ultra-conservative, critical of the West, won the presidency there this weekend. And that, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, could stall the return of much-needed Iranian crude to the world market.
Going into Iran's election last week, talks between Tehran's current government and the Biden administration were moving toward a deal to patch up differences, revive the nuclear accord, and let Iran export oil again. But with the newly elected president, Ibrahim Raisi, and his allies?
They're very skeptical of U.S. intentions.
Sarah Vakshuri heads the energy firm SVB Energy International. Since Friday's election, the price of crude has risen $3 to about $75 a barrel.
Traders are having lower expectations for Iran oil.
Meantime, other OPEC members and Russia are keeping supplies tight, all as world demand is red hot. Analyst Christopher Page at Rystad Energy says mobility is back.
Driving, flying, and starting to go back to the office. And so that combination will lead to pretty robust recovery in the United States and in Europe and in other markets of the world.
Now, this being the oil market, there is always debate, and some think Iran still wants a deal. Specifically, the Iranian supreme religious leader, says Halima Croft at RBC Capital Markets.
I think he's very desperate for sanctions relief. I mean, these are very, very tough sanctions after the U.S. withdrew from the agreement in 2018 under the Trump administration.
Whether Iran's oil returns to the world and when is a wild card in energy markets, so says Tom Kloza at the Oil Price Information Service. But as best he can tell, the price of crude will continue to rise, much like other commodities like copper and grains.
It's looking more and more likely that the third quarter of this year is going to see some spectacular appreciation in crude oil prices.
He thinks drivers this fall could pay the highest prices at the pump in 9 years. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Today, for those of you perhaps unaware, is Amazon Prime Day. So is tomorrow. You tell me how a day can be 2 days long. I got nothing. But since Amazon launched it in 2015, a whole lot of other retailers have started offering deals of their own for Prime Day. But this year, giant conglomerate and everybody else, they're all up against the same problem, tight supply chains. Marketplace's Mario Segarra is on that one.
Other retailers have started offering discounts on Prime Day because a lot of the products Amazon is discounting, you only need one of. Like, you see a lot of vacuum cleaners.
Which is for consumers, is a once every few to several years purchase. So it's the opportunity to capture that sale.
That's Chris Considine at the consulting firm Alex Partners. The question for those retailers and for Amazon is, how many of these items do they have in stock? Supply chains are a mess between the factory shutdowns and shortages of raw materials and computer chips and shipping containers. That's made it hard for retailers to build up inventory ahead of Prime Day, including the ones who sell through Amazon.
I've worked with certain sellers on Amazon in the last few months, and they've been scrambling to get the product ready for today.
If retailers don't have a lot of inventory, their deals may disappear fast. Casey Runyon is managing editor at the website Brad's Deals, which tracks retailer discounts. She says, as an example,
as I've been working today, had two laptop deals sell out within, you know, an hour or so of posting. So I think, you know, laptops have definitely been, you know, one of the biggest supply chain disruption sort of items.
Amazon declined an interview, but said it is offering more deals this year than last. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You know, it's going to be interesting, just in keeping with the whole context and connected dots vibe that we started with. It's going to be interesting to see the personal spending and personal income numbers when they come out Friday morning, whether supply chains are hitting that. On Wall Street today, all green, pretty much all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been telling you about the move by Republican governors to cut off those extra federal jobless benefits. Well, those cuts have started over the past couple of weekends. 500,000, give or take, people have been affected so far. The benefits expire nationally in September. Unemployment has, of course, fallen as more people get vaxxed and more businesses reopen. But as was the case before the pandemic, unemployment remains highest for black workers, 9.1% in May, 5.8%. is the overall population figure. And some new analysis by the federal government shows that black applicants have a harder time getting unemployment benefits. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino is on that story for us today.
The Government Accountability Office analyzed national census surveys and looked at federal unemployment program data from five states for periods during the pandemic.
We started noticing some potential racial disparities in the way that beneficiaries were being approved for benefits.
Thomas Costa with the GAO says white unemployment applicants reported getting benefits 80% of the time, while black applicants got benefits just 73% of the time. It's a pattern that's familiar to William Spriggs, an economist at Howard University.
This disparity is well known and has been documented. During the Great Recession, we had the same problem.
And he says it's partly by design. Back when the unemployment system was established in the 1930s, it excluded a lot of workers from eligibility.
It did not conceive protecting workers who were part-time or workers who were in the service sector who got very low wages.
Who were and still are disproportionately black. Federal pandemic unemployment programs should have helped compensate for inequities at the state level by expanding relief to more types of workers. But those programs are administered by the states, which have very different systems, says Andrew Stettner with the Century Foundation.
People of color tend to be concentrated in some of the states that are the most restrictive for unemployment benefits, like the Deep South and the Southwest.
Where he says the unemployed often have to navigate long and complicated online applications or fight months-long appeals to get benefits, which can disadvantage workers of color with fewer resources. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
You got 1.4 billion people in an economy. You're going to have millions and millions and millions of small businesses in normal times. In a pandemic, as we have seen here in this country, millions of those small businesses are going to shut down. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports from Shanghai's competitive coffee scene on what it takes to survive.
There's a storefront on Hunan Road in Shanghai's French Concession. It's an alluring mix of jazz music, sleek wooden panels, and leather seats. I've mistaken it for a bar every time I've walked past, but it's actually a coffee shop, a high-end one called Rumors Coffee.
When we first opened the shop 11 years ago, we were the only ones to specialize in hand-dripped coffee. and we gradually started seeing other shops price their coffee the same as ours.
That's one of the owners, Keiichi Nakayama from Japan. His wife, Liu Yan, who co-runs the place, says other coffee shops want to copy more than just their price.
Some business owners brought their own designers in and started to measure the bar counter secretly. Our menus have been stolen. Customers told us that there's a coffee training school that was using our name.
It's a cutthroat business, more so with the COVID-19 pandemic. A coffee shop called Nameless opened in the middle of last year, just as Shanghai was fully reopening from a lockdown. Juzi is the owner.
After I opened my coffee shop, I found that within 6 months, a few more opened nearby. Coffee shops pop up in Shanghai so fast.
There are 7 to 8 coffee shops within a 1 mile radius of her own, and Juzi is feeling the pressure. Even though she sells her coffee below prices offered at Starbucks, the industry standard in China.
Some new shops are offering an Americano for $1.40, half price if you bring your own cup. That's frightening. It is not a good trend.
Instead, Juzi stays in the game by keeping her staff small. And as for rent, well, she splits it with another business.
We make coffee in the front. They sell paintings and do framing in the back.
And rent is the biggest headache for business owners in pricey Shanghai. Again, Rumors Coffee co-owner Liu Yan.
To cope with high rent, most coffee shops sell liquor at night and other products.
She and her husband have resisted doing so. Their focus is on maintaining quality and variety. They have 40 different types of coffee beans on hand that they roast themselves. One cup costs anywhere from $10 to $20. Again, co-owner Nakayama.
A lot of people cannot go abroad because of the pandemic. So people are spending their money here. If you serve coffee that pleases people, the word will get out and we get repeat business. So during the pandemic, the number of customers we are getting is increasing.
He and his wife feel China's coffee culture is still in its infancy. Shanghai may have nearly 7,000 coffee shops, but outside of the financial capital, they're not that popular. Just ask the barista at Nameless Coffee, Liu Yi, who is from a small Chinese city. He tells me the first time he drank coffee was when he started working here, at the age of 20. And yet, his coffee-making skills have left a deep impression on customers like Xiong Lu Ying, who is visiting from Wuhan City. She's been here once before.
That day, I chose a particular bean, and since it was a hot day, I requested an iced coffee. This barista said he tried making it twice and told me it does not reflect the bean's best taste. He suggested I change to a hot coffee.
Then barista Liu Yi says, "Oh, that was you," and they strike up a conversation. So in a city of 24 million, the personal touch also makes for repeat customers. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They weren't wanting to do it for onesie-twosies.
Yeah, we only got time for mass vaccinations around here. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 586 points today, 1.7%, closed at 33,876. All 30 of the blue chip stocks green today. All 30 of the blue chip stocks red on Friday. Go figure. NASDAQ gained 111 points, 0.7%, 14,141. There's a palindrome in there somewhere. The S&P 500 up 58 points, 1.4%, finished at 4224. Look, another one. It's like Palindrome Monday here. Apple polished up 1.4% today on reports tech giant is moving forward with plans to make self-driving cars in the next 3 years. I'm going to take the under. Tesla dipped 0.3% yesterday. Car maker unveiled images of its in-house supercomputer that will help power the company's autopilot and self-driving systems. See my prior doubt about Apple. Ford picked up 1.7% today. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.49%. You are listening, as you are every day, I hope, to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There has been no shortage of supply chain shortages in this pandemic. We have talked a lot about the big ones: semiconductors, lumber, steel. I could go on, but here is the big picture question about all of that. What is the holdup right now? To try to figure it out, we got Dr. Nada Sanders on the phone. She is a distinguished professor of supply chain management at Northeastern. And to find the answer, she says, you got to go back a little bit.
We saw the toilet paper shortages, hand sanitizer, you know, meat, right? And so people realize now, wait, hey, you know, I don't just press a button and things magically show up. Now imagine if that's with toilet paper, what's the case going to be when you're talking about chips, when you're talking about, you know, pharma and so forth?
Yeah, and that's where we find ourselves today, right, with the chips and the pharma. But let me back you up to toilet paper, right? We all looked at, regular consumers went to the store, there was no toilet paper, and we consulted supply chain experts, and they said, oh my goodness, well, you know, residential toilet paper is really different than commercial toilet paper. And we all kind of went, oh, okay, that makes sense. But it does kind of speak to the fragility of things, right? The idea that
Absolutely.
That was a tough transition to make, kind of, it makes you go, really? If that's hard, what else aren't we doing right, you know?
Exactly. And coming into the pandemic, our supply chains globally had become enormously complex. We also have relied on something called lean or just-in-time mm-hmm. inventory systems. That really means no or very little inventory in the pipeline. And I'm telling you, we're going to see a restructuring of supply chains. I'm already seeing companies that are talking about bringing a lot of it back home, vertical integration. But bottom line is that we have a really fragile global supply chain that had been overly leaned out. Things are going to change, but it's going to take a long time.
The reason, ostensibly, that those supply chains got so long and so complicated and so just in time oriented was to provide goods to consumers at the lowest cost to companies, obviously, but then consumers don't have to pay higher prices. And do you suppose do you suppose that as things get restructured and supply chains get shortened and you know, just-in-time inventory winds up being lots of stuff in a warehouse somewhere, consumers are going to wind up paying higher prices?
Absolutely. Huh. What companies are doing is moving from a just-in-time to, you know, you might have heard some people call it a just-in-case. Mm-hmm. It is going to mean fewer choices, higher prices, longer lead times.
Do you anticipate, and look, none of this is going to happen fast, right? That's the caveat. But do you anticipate that supply chains get restructured in a way that might affect the recovery? I mean, things are looking really promising now. Life is good. People are happy. They're spending money. Economy's growing. Is the supply chain going to change that?
I think that we really haven't repopulated those supply chains. They haven't been restructured, and it takes time. And I really worry. I mean, look at the cyber attacks.
Yeah.
Any disruption that could happen puts us in a really vulnerable position. And also, we are so globally connected. And we look at countries like India, that is the primary source of generic drugs. So what could happen is we have ill workers as we, you know, have a slowdown in that production. It's kind of frightening.
All right. So just as a way to wrap this up, let me take you back to where we started. As we sit here in the midsummer-ish of 2021, what's the toilet paper of this year that you're thinking about supply chain wise?
The toilet paper of this year is definitely the semiconductors. Yeah. The other issue I think is really important is what's going on with the labor markets. I think we are seeing some really dramatic shifts in terms of skill sets that are being mm-hmm. required, wages. We are moving back into very much a service sector economy, but we don't have enough service workers.
And workers are, of course, part of the supply chain. Dr. Nada Saunders. She is a distinguished professor of supply chain management at Northeastern University. Professor, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You miss us on the air somehow? Get our podcast, would you? Marketplace.org or your favorite platform. So one of the big supply chain stories, of course, are car makers getting jammed up by semiconductor shortages. Turns out that is not the only thing they're dealing with. Auto plants across the South are hitting a wall with vaccination rates, the South being where shots lag the rest of the country. Catch is, higher demand for new cars has assembly lines having to run full tilt. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer has that one.
Many car plants have been making the vaccine about as accessible as can be, offering it to employees on site.
Doesn't matter.
In April, Ford put out video of workers getting the jab on the job. General Motors partnered with vaccine providers to do the same. At its Spring Hill, Tennessee plant, the local health department came in twice, but plant manager Jeff Lamar says still fewer than half his workers are vaccinated. At this point, he doesn't feel good asking the busy local health nurses to come back and wait around on any takers.
Because they weren't wanting to do it for onesie-twosies. They were looking for a bigger event.
Lamar says he had hoped that the promise of being able to stop wearing masks in a hot car plant would be enough. So far, it's not. In fact, the United Auto Workers decided in early June to keep most of the COVID protocols like mask wearing and social distancing and continued urging its members to roll up their sleeves and get vaccinated. LaMarche is sort of at a loss.
The further you push it, you're just not getting any more response rate. It's maxed out. What do? You just move on and say, okay, folks, we're all responsible adults.
GM has resisted turning to financial incentives. Lamar says if workers really need convincing, he'd rather just require the shot, though he says that's not on the table at this point. Seeing that workers might need some coaxing, Toyota has been offering workers a $100 bonus from the beginning. Employees just have to send in a picture of their vaccination card to Emily Lauder.
And so that's how we're tracking the percentages of folks that are vaccinated site by site.
Lauder leads the COVID response for Toyota's American plants. She says the rates range from around 30% at the high end to less than 15% where she's based at Toyota's Mississippi plant. She says the company's rate of vaccination in Kentucky is higher than in Mississippi, for instance. That mirrors the state vaccination trend in the overall population. With car sales humming, it's not a question of whether the company could afford to up the ante. Toyota's car sales are up nearly 80% compared to last year. It's contemplated starting a sweepstakes and giving vaccination holdouts a chance to win a car. But Lauder says she's torn.
Some of the other incentives that we have considered, we're still struggling to figure out how far to go.
There's employee morale to consider, which is a big deal at a car plant with thousands of workers. Robert Burns is in charge of human resources for Hyundai's plant in Montgomery, Alabama.
Going and offering incentive to someone who has not, and then the people who already got it says, well, what about me?
While Hyundai hasn't sweetened the pot with bonuses or car giveaways, it has tried to make it easy to get the shot in a partnership with a local health system. Burns says the only real perk is the hope of being able to sit together at lunch again and no more prepackaged food in the cafeteria.
There's things we do that we'd like to get back to some degree of normal, and that's the rationale for it.
It's working for Hyundai, with better than half of employees immunized. The plant had just one positive COVID case in the month of May, but it hasn't yet reached the herd immunity Hyundai wants. So there are no plans yet for workers to take off their masks on the production line. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am not making this up. Bloomberg had the story. Is there a Wingstop near you? It's a fast food place that does chicken wings as the main attraction. Well, it might not surprise you to hear that there is a shortage of chicken wings right now, supply chains being what they are. So the company has pivoted and launched a new brand. I love this. Thigh Stop. Seriously, Thigh Stop. Come on. Supply chains are cool. All right, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context. One last supply chain gasp, but it's good news for a change. Those of you planning additions to your houses or new construction or just something that's going to need lumber, take heart. Prices down 45% from their peak about, beginning of May. Still high, but going in the right non-inflationary way. There's that word. I said inflation. Oh, well. Oh, well. Our daily production team includes Anis Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.